This is the Actual Fluency Podcast, helping you become a better language learner by providing motivating weekly inspiration, as well as top tips and tricks from expert guests. And now, your host, Chris Broholm.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Actual Fluency Podcast. And on this podcast, I'm happy to invite Mr. Michael Levi Harris, who is the writer and star of the Hyperglub movie, which I saw for the first time at the Polyglot Gathering in Berlin, and I also saw it in New York for the Polyglot Conference, and it's also on iTunes, so if you haven't seen it yet, it's about a young man learning a lot of languages, hence the name Hyperglot, and what kind of adventures he can go on. And it's on iTunes, so if you go search for the Hyperglot, you'll be able to find it. And during the interview, we get into, of course, the movie, and we talk about, you know, what was the inspiration, how did he actually get to the point where he can just create a short film, you know, it's over 20 minutes, and how that relates to his personality as a language learner, and also, are there any similarities between the main character in the movie and then Michael in real life. And during the way, we get a lot of sort of, I don't know if you want to call it philosophical, but we get into like a lot of language learning topics. So it's really a nice kind of fireside chat with Michael, and he's incredibly interesting to listen to. And that's why I also had to split the episode up in two. And another little note, unfortunately there's no video this week because we had to record on location at Michael's school, the Guildhall School for Acting and Drama. Something like that. Acting and drama seems very similar. I probably messed that up. But anyway, it was his school where he's on the final year as an acting student. It's a very prestigious school. So we recorded there, and I didn't really have a way to record it. I could use this webcam, but it's kind of hard to fit two people in it. And yeah. So unfortunately, no video this week. But you're going to enjoy also just the voices of me and Michael, and I had to record it using my phone, so again, it's not as rich as it would have been back in the studio back in Hungary. So that interview is coming up in just a moment, but before, I just wanted to talk about what I've been doing lately. I went to London, which is why the background is different, and I've been here for 2 weeks now, and I just visited friends and went to my company's Christmas party, and after that, basically just hanging out, and I went to the Memrise offices to talk about the upcoming Poly Membus tour, which if you haven't heard about it, you should really check it out. It's on Kickstarter, search for Memrise or Membus, and you can see what kind of amazing project it is. Basically, they want to, for the new generation of Memrise, they want to record native speakers saying sentences and words, so you just use the video in the flashcard courses, so kind of evolving the flashcards to be more interactive, which is going to be really cool because I think you can gain a lot by seeing how words are pronounced, like what are the mouth movements and, you know, what kind of, also, you know, what kind of body stance do you take, and if you're learning Italian, for instance, you know, maybe you get the hand gestures, who knows. So I'm really excited about that, and as I was talking to them about them, and I'll put some more information on the website in a few days, actualfluency.com. As I was talking about them, they said that I could go on the bus, and I was like, yes! And they said, if two of your audience decides to support the Kickstarter campaign at the level where they get to go on the bus. So if two of you guys out there are interested in going on the most epic polyglot road trip ever attempted, which is quite epic, and you know, you go to the Kickstarter and support it, and make sure you tell them that you were sent there through Chris from Actual Fluency, I'm gonna go with you, and that could be great fun. I would have loved to support with the full amount, but unfortunately I don't have the finances at the moment. Maybe closer to the starting date. It starts during next year, and maybe then I'll be able to support it. But just for now, you know, if you're really keen on going with this epic adventure, recording native speakers of all around Europe in a retro two-decker London bus, then, you know, go to the Kickstarter and search for Membus, because it's going to be epic. And there are also, you know, pledges at lower levels. You can pledge relatively small amounts and then get memorized swag packs, which include like t-shirts and notebooks and all this kind of cool stuff. And I love Memrise. I use it a lot for my vocabulary, and I love the company as well. They have a great business model, and they always, they're always very nice and friendly to talk to the community. They feature other people's content on their social channels. They have guest bloggers, and they're very in tune with everything, and I really like that as a company. And they're just really nice people, so that's why I'm using a lot of time to talk about Memrise. But yeah, if you're interested in that, go and check it out on Kickstarter. And now it's time to hear from the creator of the Hyperglove movie, Mr. Michael Levi Harris.
Could you tell everyone just, your story of how you got into language learning and sort of the story up to the movie and how you got involved with learning so many languages?
I think it probably starts with my best friend in kindergarten. So the very first day of kindergarten, my mom took me out to the bus stop. I grew up in a suburb of New York City, so like 30 minutes outside of the city. Kind of very typical what people think of in the movies, American suburb. So a yellow school bus picked me up for school and all that. So my mom took me to the bus stop on the first day of kindergarten, and there was a Japanese boy with his mom, and they were speaking Japanese to each other. And as far as I could really tell at that time, I had never heard of another language spoken, at least in a context like that. And I was completely dumbfounded that they were communicating with each other and I couldn't understand what they were saying. And I had to know what they were talking about. Oh, wow. And it was, I still remember it. It's a very vivid memory. I remember asking my mom, what are they saying? Why can't I understand them? And she explained to me that they're speaking another language. And I don't recall if she knew that it was Japanese or not. But anyway, it turned out that this boy, Yutaka, was in my class at school. And I just, from day one, was obsessed with him. I had to sit next to him every time we were, in a circle, and I became his best friend. And our teacher kind of assigned me to be his helper and help him learn English because he didn't speak any English. But I was less interested in helping him learn English. I wanted to know what he was saying in Japanese, and I found myself, just sort of imitating him, not in a mean way, obviously, but there were other Japanese students in the school, and I would pick up on all the things that they said to each other and try and mimic it and participate in this conversation, even though I didn't really understand what I was saying. But I distinctly remember that it got to a point where I seemed to be able to interpret for him. I mean, I can remember going to the nurse with him when, he hit his head or something, and going to the nurse as his interpreter and saying, she would ask what was wrong and I would say something to him and he would respond back to me and I would tell her what happened. And
wow.
And the thing is, in my memory of it, it feels like I was making it up. But he seemed to be talking to, he didn't think I was making it up somehow. And I had the entire school fooled, with the exception of the kindergarten teacher, because I remember going to the, music, or she came to pick us up from our music teacher one day, and the music teacher said, "How does Michael Levi Harris speak Japanese?" And the teacher said, "What are you talking about? He doesn't speak Japanese." And, but what I think I was doing was maybe what children do when they learn languages is sort of just imitate sounds and pick up on words and associate meanings. And I definitely have in my memory certain words and things that I did learn, because when I revisited Japanese many years later, things came back to me that I couldn't imagine how else, it was like a deja vu of
right. Language.
So anyway, Yutaka and I were best friends for 3 years until he moved back to Japan in second grade. And then I suddenly found myself, without my best friend and kind of friendless. And and a bit sad, and there were other Japanese kids, but I wasn't necessarily friendly with them. But I suddenly realized I was lucky enough to grow up in a place where there were lots of international people, you know, different companies' headquarters in the city, and so they had houses for the families to live in the suburbs, or people who worked for the UN and things like that. And so there were Brazilian kids, there were Swedish siblings, Russian. I mean, a couple of kids from sort of all over the world, and then certain populations that were very big. There were a lot of Japanese and a lot of Koreans and quite a few Brazilians, actually. And I suddenly realized that there was a whole, you know, world of people speaking different languages, and it wasn't just Japanese that interested me, and I became absolutely obsessed with all of them. And every year I would have sort of a new best friend who, based on what language they spoke. And I got really into Berlitz dictionaries, Berlitz travel phrase books. That seemed to be the biggest thing at the time. You know, this is giving away my age. In the late 80s and early 90s, it was. I don't think language learning was quite what it is today. If you went into a bookstore to the language section, it was pretty much, you know, maybe some French and Spanish books, and then Berlitz things. And it was the best thing my dad could buy me for my birthday or anything. It was just a new language, and I had the whole collection: Norwegian, Dutch, Arabic, Finnish, whatever Berlitz there was. By the end of my childhood, I had all of them, and I never really used them effectively. I just like to have them and to flip through them and, you know, learn how to say certain things. And
So these were just dictionaries,
they were
or was
sort of
did they
phrase
have?
books. They
Oh,
were
right.
for travelers, so there were, you know,
Right.
different sections of everyday phrases
Oh, yeah,
and
they're quite good.
emergency situations and whatever else. And they're probably quite useful things. I mean, especially, you know, before the internet and before cell phones or whatever, if you were going somewhere and really wanted to try and communicate, it was probably very handy to have. But I never traveled anywhere at that point. It was my only sort of window into other languages.
Pretty crazy. That's the most sort of immersive language style I've ever heard of. You know, where you just see it and you hear it with your own eyes and you get that fascination right away. I mean, that's incredible. And how did you channel that sort of growing up? And did you just continue getting more books and studying other ways, or did you look into actually making it a career or learn more languages professionally?
Well, when I was in college, in my last year of college, very inconveniently too late in life, I was diagnosed with ADHD and told that based on whatever patterns, this was something I had my whole life. Which didn't surprise me in the least, because, and a perfect example is I would say the reason why I speak so many languages is because I could never focus on one or concentrate on one. And I just, so it was always, there was a new flavor of the month, and I would sort of get bored of it and then have to go on to the next one, but then I would go back, and I was always doing that in different countries. For whatever reason, would just take up my interest at different times. And I was very much interested in, you know, alphabets that I couldn't read, and, you know, wanting to learn to read them. And I mean, it's so weird when I just sort of think of memories of my childhood. I remember I had this dictionary, just an English language dictionary, but at the front of it had five alphabets and how to pronounce them. There was the Hebrew alphabet, the Cyrillic alphabet, the Greek alphabet, the old German alphabet that was written with, you know, before World War II. And I can just remember, you know, just staring at that
Right.
as for fun. That was like my idea of reading, was I would just open that book up and look at the letters. And so yeah, I was always trying to do something with different languages, and and it sort of depended a lot on who was around me. So these different kids in school and who I took a liking to for whatever reason, and whatever was being spoken around me at the time that I couldn't understand, I suddenly had to, and that never went away. And you know, when we talk about the hyperglot later, that part of the basis of that is even as an adult, I was eavesdropping on a conversation that I couldn't understand, and I was very, not only could I not understand it, but I couldn't identify the language, and that upset me even more, because by the time I, you know, reached adulthood, I've become very good at identifying a language, even if I don't speak it. So I know, you know, what Finnish sounds like, or Hungarian, or, but even without speaking them. But this language, Maltese, when it was being spoken, and I couldn't identify it, and I was just, you know, was driving me nuts until I could.
Yeah.
And so that's always been the case. And I think I had different motivations for... So some motivation, or an example of a motivation, why I started learning or looking into different languages. I mean, as a child, I became aware of the fact that my great grandparents came from different countries, and that suddenly made me feel, you know, special. Like there was a different language in my, you know, heritage as well, and they were all from the Russian Empire, which of course at the time I didn't, you know, really understand. Well, I think there was still the Soviet Union when I found this out, so that was kind of similar borders to the Russian Empire itself. Yeah. But, you know, so I just thought they were from Russia. Of course, today it was Belarus and Ukraine and different places. But when I was a kid, I thought, oh, I'm Russian, so I should learn Russian. And I became really into trying to learn Russian. And I, at some point, probably by the time I got to middle school, the language sections of bookstores started to expand a little. So I remember the next series that I got into was the 10 minutes a day series. There was, you know, Russian in 10 minutes a day. And you bought these books and they came with stickers, you know, for various things around your house, and you would put the stickers on things. So I was covering my entire house in stickers for, you know, plates and salt and whatever in Russian and German. And they had vocabulary cards that you would cut out. And that was, so I taught myself to read the Cyrillic alphabet with that. And it wasn't actually just language either. I mean, I was really interested in the cultures as well. So I can remember in third grade, there were these books, in the classroom, Count Your Way Through, Name the Country. So one of them was Count Your Way Through Russia.
Right.
And each chapter, which was all of, you know, two pages, was a different number. And there would be something relating to that number about the country. And I was, I mean, I was first drawn to it by the language aspect that, you know, it would teach you один, dva, tri, you know, and then teach you about it. And there was Count Your Way Through Israel, which is another country that I felt connection with because I'm Jewish and I grew up, you know, learning about Jewish history and culture and all of that. And Israel was, you know, connected to that. So those two particular books stick out in my mind because I thought, oh, these are, you know, the books that relate to me. And Hebrew is another language that I was exposed to, therefore, as a child a lot. Although I'm not, you know, again, I think it's interesting how children develop kind of awareness of what different languages mean, because, you know, I pinpoint this interaction with Yutaka in kindergarten as my first exposure to a foreign language. But in truth, I had been to synagogue and Hebrew and a Jewish nursery school before that. And I remember learning songs in Hebrew in Hebrew school, but it didn't like register that that was a foreign language or that that was, you know, something that people spoke. It was just, to me, that's just what you did in nursery school. And that's what you did in when you went to temple, people sang in this language but I don't think I had a concept of it as really a foreign language. And similarly, probably what added to that confusion was that, my parents and grandparents used a lot of Yiddish words in their regular vocabulary. And some of them I grew up learning second nature as the, if they were my own, but every so often there'd be a word that was less frequently used that I could identify as a word that I, you know, didn't know what that meant, and it sounded funny, and I would ask and what that meant, and my parents would say, oh, it's Yiddish, and it means whatever. And even I would say, even until my later childhood, when I did know what different languages were, I still didn't even realize that Yiddish was an actual language. You know, to me, Yiddish was like this collection of words that old Jewish people use. And I'm not alone in that. A lot of Jewish people, you know, I remember I actually studied Yiddish in university. And you'd be surprised at how many people, even Jewish people that you meet, who'd say, like, is Yiddish really a language? You know, I just thought it was words. And so I think my exposures prior to Japanese being random Yiddish words in Hebrew songs in temple and nursery school didn't quite solidify to me that there were such a thing as different languages. Right. And but once I that became clear, and I thought, oh, well, I've got, you know, Yiddish is part of my heritage, and Hebrew is part of my heritage, and Russian is part of my heritage, and so I became interested in those languages. But of course, in my school, there weren't really kids that spoke those. I mean, there was a Russian girl once for maybe a year, but then she left. But there were Brazilian kids, and there were Japanese kids, and so the first language that I really taught myself fluently and very with some persistence was Portuguese, because I was enamored of all the Brazilians in my school. Right. I thought they were the coolest people, and they were so fun, and they'd have me over to their house, and their moms would make these Brazilian treats called brigadeiros, which I learned to make, and in fact I have a batch at home in my refrigerator because I'm having a party tomorrow, and I make them. So so I was just really into that, and by that time, you know, again, the language section was expanding. This was my favorite activity, to go to the mall, you know, on a Friday night with my best friend in middle school, whose name was Maggie, to go to the bookstore and just get lost in the language section. And it seemed every year to grow bigger and bigger. So by this time, I discovered Pimsleur. And Pimsleur was fantastic. And I can remember what a big deal it was, because it was quite expensive. It was something like maybe $300 to order this set of 30 cassettes. And I begged my parents for so long and they just, you know, I don't blame them. It seemed like a very extravagant
That's a lot of money,
gift yeah. for a 10-year-old, or however old I was, 11 or 12. And I really had to push them. Of course, now in retrospect, I think if they had known how really into it I was, and how much more able you are to absorb it as a child, I think they wouldn't have hesitated and would have gotten me 10 languages, and I could be, you know, speaking 20 right now. But who knew, I guess. But anyway, eventually I managed to convince them to get it for me. And I really used it, and I really got good at it. And when I remember going at one point to Miami to visit my grandparents, and there's a fairly sizable Brazilian community there, and we went to a Brazilian restaurant, and I spoke Portuguese with all the wait staff, and my parents were suitably impressed that I had done this, so they agreed to get me the next level of Portuguese. Oh. And I only had the first two levels, and that was it. Between that and being able to converse with the kids at school, and I bought a grammar book, and I bought vocabulary cards, and I really immersed myself. And I reached fluency, you know, by, I don't know, I was maybe 14 or 15, and maybe not perfectly. I mean, I that's the whole discussion of fluency is yeah. something that drives me nuts, but I was pretty good, let's say.
Yeah.
And the thing that everybody commented on, that even from a young age, that my parents, you know, picked up on, and I think I picked up on as well, is that I had a really good ear for accents and pronunciation. So when I spoke a language, it sounded really good, and right. people were convinced that I was completely fluent, even if I wasn't. Which later in life kind of poses a problem, actually. If you, you know, if you can only say a few sentences, but you say them really well,
Oh,
then
yeah.
people suddenly think like, oh, you're fluent, so I could just speak at rapid, you know, conversational pace.
Yeah, every day.
Yeah.
Every day we run into this. It's crazy.
And I had Japanese neighbors at one point, and we were invited to their house for dinner, and this is going back to being about 10 or so, and I was saying some things that I knew in Japanese, and the wife of the couple, she insisted that I must have been born in Japan, because not because I was speaking fluent Japanese, but because my pronunciation was so accurate that I sounded like a Japanese child,
right.
And she couldn't understand how that was possible.
But that's what you spent all your young years doing. You were imitating how they spoke.
Exactly.
So that's what you were training.
Yeah. And I still have a good Japanese accent, and I still don't speak Japanese. but when I mean what little I can, I say quite well. And I've noticed it's gotten harder as I've gotten older. I know, because I remember, so I learned French in high school. That was my first foreign language that I officially, you know, studied as part of school. And I think when I was 14, I went on a, my parents sent me, I was done with summer camp, which was what all my friends did. And so instead I went on this French language course in Switzerland. And I remember, I don't remember if it was France or Switzerland where I landed, because we did a little trip in Paris first. But at the passport control, I spoke in French. And then when I handed her my passport, the woman she was just shocked that I was American.
Right.
And that gave me such a good, you know, feeling and validation of, you know, that I still am good at this. And in college, I spent a summer in Brazil, and I traveled around. And when I was in different parts of Brazil, they thought I was from another part of Brazil.
Right.
Obviously not where they were from, but,
of course.
And usually because I have blonde hair and blue eyes, they thought I was from the south, very southern tip of Brazil, where there's a lot of people of German descent. And so this is a thing that I've had, and I still get it. I mean, people always compliment my pronunciation. Now, what I've noticed as I've gotten older, and maybe people are just more honest, I don't know, is that they no longer quite say that I sound like a native speaker in a language that I don't speak, which has started to bother me. But I also think that kind of has to do with surroundings. And so, like, if I spend a long time in a place, I feel, I don't know, I'm which unfortunately I've never really had the opportunity to do, but I feel kind of confident that I would sound like a native speaker.
Yeah.
And it's just something that you have to, because even here in England, you know, acting, and I have to act in an English accent, which I can do, you know, and I've been told by English people that I make a very convincing Englishman, and they, you know, often people didn't know that I wasn't English. But that, first of all, it helps to be living here and hearing that all the time. But even to achieve that, I spent about 3 months speaking in an English accent, even outside of school, just in my life and in everything, 24/7.
Yeah.
Because otherwise, that's the only way to kind of get your mouth to automatically go in the right sort of shapes.
Exactly.
And then once I sort of felt like I achieved that really well, I thought, okay, I should practice just going back and forth between English and American, because I should be able to do that skill. And that's actually was very hard.
Right.
And I found myself making a lot of slip-ups when I wasn't speaking English in a British accent, you know, 24/7.
Now is probably a good time to get into the movie, Hyperglot.
Yeah.
First of all, award-winning a movie, I should say.
Mm-hmm.
Congratulations on the great results at the various small film festivals and
thank you.
Big ones too. And I love the movie. And the biggest question I suppose everyone asks you, and that I have to ask you, is like, how similar is Jake to Michael? I mean, is that a biographical representation or?
I tend to tell people it's semi-autobiographical in the sense that it is. It is based on lots of true occurrences in my life, right. Namely the main event of the film, which I won't spoil for right. people who haven't seen it yet. But that is a true story that happened to me, right. that I showed up expecting one group of people and found something quite different, right. All in pursuit of language learning. So that really happened to me, and various, I mean, the opening scene with the three guys speaking Arabic and making a lewd comment about the waitress, that didn't happen quite verbatim the way it did, but that was completely a true occurrence in real life. It was on the subway, and I was about to get off at the next stop, and I had been eavesdropping on these guys because they were having a really interesting conversation about politics that I was really into at the time. And I could only, because the train was so loud, I was sort of getting snippets of it. So I was concentrating really hard. And then when the train kind of came into this station and a woman came on and they suddenly interrupted this really heated political discussion to make a comment about her. And it was a very funny one. So I just I sort of uncontrollably laughed. And they looked at me and, you know, and asked if I spoke Arabic, and I just sort of, and I had registered that I'd been, you know, standing right. there for quite some time, so I kind of shrugged, and then they started to converse with me, but then I had to get off at the next stop. So in that sense, those are all quite semi-autobiographical. I think as a character, I am a lot like Jake, but I don't think I'm quite as sort of socially inept and kind of, I don't know, he's like befuddled a bit.
Right. It's a bit goofy.
Yeah, and I think I drew on parts of my personality that are like that, but as a whole, I don't think I present right. myself that way. So, yeah, you know, I think actually in anything that you act in, you have to find the ways in which you relate to the character and find the ways in which you're different. So obviously, because I wrote it, it was very easy for me to find the ways in which I was similar. And it was more about me choosing what I thought would be more entertaining or enjoyable, in terms of, well, I'm going to, you know, let me extract this bit of my personality and use that for Jake, but let me cover up the fact, you know, I won't use the fact that I'm actually pretty good in social situations. Right. Because I don't know, there's something endearing about watching somebody kind of who's likable but stumbles his way through. And I don't know, maybe I'm giving my real self too much credit. Maybe I am kind of awkward. So yeah, semi-autobiographical.
Right. So where did it come from? You mentioned during your early story, you mentioned that you had the idea for a long time, that it connected. So how do you, you know, you want to be an actor and you had this idea about language learning, or what happened first actually?
Well, so I'd been acting in New York already for a couple of years professionally, with moderate success. I mean, when I started acting, I said I would give myself a certain amount of time before I called it quits. Right. And I wasn't really sure how much time that would be, but I just thought I would kind of know, you know, if you spend 2 years going to auditions and getting absolutely zilch, maybe you should rethink right. what you're doing, unless money's not an issue for you or whatever. But that was not the case for me. I was having lots of little success, and I took this really great career path course that kind of taught how to measure your success, and which sounds so silly now, but I mean, it's it was actually really helpful. That basically, if you can find a way to measure your success and that you are in fact improving, then you're doing well. And I noted that I was every year I was getting, you know, more auditions, more callbacks, more roles, more money, in small increments. So I thought I was, you know, doing okay, but I was getting antsy that I wasn't quite doing what I wanted. You know, I had some great experiences acting in plays, but you know, some of them were very small, and didn't pay much. And I wanted more. I mean, as everybody wants, I think, to be
Sure.
doing really well in whatever it is that they're doing. And I really wanted to try my hand in film because I hadn't gotten to do that yet. And I was at a party of an actor friend who, and I was talking to this guy who was saying, who, you know, was an actor, and he said, I think the way to go is you just have to produce your own stuff. You know, you can easily make a film for a short film for $300, you know, no problem. And I thought, well, what does that entail? I mean, I really know anything about short films. I always thought a short film was was like a 40-minute or a 60-minute film. You know, it was a film, a proper film, but not long enough to be a feature film. And this guy said, "No way. Some of the best short films are 5 minutes long. In fact, for film festivals, that's ideal. They like the 5-minute length." And I suddenly just had this epiphany of, "Oh, I have a really great story that would probably be able to be told in 5 minutes." And that was because that this incident, the real life incident, had just happened to me, not that, you know, long, and I when I told people about what happened, they, you know, fell out of their chair laughing. And I thought, if everybody that I tell, you know, that I tell the story to has that reaction, it must be a good story. So if a 5-minute film is a good length for a film, let me turn this into a film. And so that was sort of the birth of the idea. And then, of course, the birth of the story, if that's what you were getting at, was just that I was listening to this conversation between two people who, oh gosh, I hate, you know, trying to be diplomatic and politically correct and all that, but I mean, I looked at them and they looked European to me. Sorry if that offends anybody. And they were speaking a language that I couldn't identify, and I was just like, "Wow, what is this, you know, language?" And even if they, I mean, they looked, no, they, I would say actually maybe more accurately, they looked Mediterranean, and I thought, well, I speak Hebrew and I speak Arabic and I speak Italian and Spanish and I know what Greek sounds like, and you know, there was every language I could think of that I and Turkish, and I just couldn't get it, and I thought, and then I thought I heard words that sounded like Arabic. So immediately I thought it must be Albanian because I don't, that's maybe one European language that I don't really know what it sounds like, but I know that it's a Muslim majority country, so maybe they have borrowed words from Arabic, just like Persian and Turkish. And so I thought, oh, they must be Albanian. And so finally I got, you know, got up the courage to ask, and they told me, you know, that they were from Malta. And then suddenly I had this memory, you know, from like years ago when I was studying Middle Eastern languages and cultures. Somewhere along the lines, somewhere, you know, in my past, I had heard that Maltese was a Semitic language, and it was the only one written in the Latin alphabet, because Malta had been colonized by Arabs at some point in history. And I thought, oh, I can't believe I didn't think of that, and I felt really stupid. But then I suddenly, it was just reinvigorated my, you know, my interest in Maltese, and I thought, I have to learn this language because it's, you know, must be similar to Arabic, and there must be a lot of Italian influence, and I knew some of the history of Malta. So I thought, you know, I set out on a quest to like find some language, Maltese language learning materials, which are few and far between.
Not
So I
easy.
was very unsuccessful in trying to actually find them, but. So that was the birth of the incident and then the birth of the film. And then, of course, once I had the idea to make this film, I started to write the script down, and it went through so many versions. I mean, the first script to the last script bears almost no resemblance except for the
The
event.
core, yeah.
And even that, you know, was changed a lot. And at some point what I realized in the writing of it was that the only reason why people, all those people that I told the story to, laughed at this story is because they know me and they could just see this happening to me and how funny that is. And I realized that for an audience of strangers, they won't, I don't think that they would think that just the main event is particularly funny or noteworthy without knowing some of my background. Mm-hmm. So that's why it turned into a 23-minute film instead of a 5-minute film, because I realized I had to explain why somebody would be going to meet a group of Maltese people to learn Maltese, which just seems so random. Right. And then, of course, to make the plot twist more, to make the audience care more about it, you needed to add a kind of a human element, which is where the love story bit comes in. And some of that was taken from personal experience in terms of people that I've, been out with and stories that I've heard from other, the dating stories. I just sort of lumped all the bad ones together in one person. That's sort of how it came about. And I realized in order to explain the character, I had lots of material, from personal experience to demonstrate in a humorous way this quirky person who is obsessed with language learning and actually it's sort of giving me an idea about how in the short film what you see is kind of the result of somebody who's obsessed with language learning. He already speaks all these languages.
Yeah, exactly.
And maybe the next, the next film, whether it's a short film or feature length, I don't know, but maybe that should delve more into the learning part, the obsessive learning of it in a way. Right. And why, and the reasons behind that, I don't know.
The few steps between. But it sounds like you're just continuing from your childhood experiences, and every time you hear something, you just get so interested in it, and when you hear it around you, and that's when you decide to learn, I presume, Arabic. You had some kind of interaction at some point, for school or any of that kind. So you just decided to go full on and learn it. So.
In a way, well, actually, the reason I learned Arabic was... So by the end of high school, I had taken French, Spanish, and Latin and ancient Greek at school. I convinced my dean at school that rather than taking physics, I should be allowed to take another language. So I did ancient Greek before school. Talk about dedication. Yeah. We met at 7:15. 3 days a week before school started to translate the Iliad. And frankly, to be honest, the only reason I did that was because they didn't have another living language at my school that I could have learned. And same with Latin. I took Latin. I mean, I thought Latin would be interesting to take, but if there had been a living language, I would have taken that. Yeah. But I don't regret it because Latin was wonderful to take, and I formed a wonderful friendship with my Latin teacher, who I'm still in touch with. And it was really useful to go from that to learning other languages. In fact, it was for my Latin class that we had to do. The teacher assigned us you had to do a research project that was not related to the Latin language, but something Roman culture or whatever. And again, I had to convince her to let me do something that was more linguistic related. And I don't know how I came up with this idea, but I just, when I was thinking about what could I talk, how could I connect the Romance languages in a sort of research project, and when I was looking at what they were, I knew Portuguese, I knew French, I knew Spanish. I didn't know Italian quite yet, but I had picked a lot up along the way. But what I hadn't realized that Romanian was a Romance language. And when I discovered that, and I thought, gee, I know absolutely nothing about Romanian. And again, it was one of those things. I remember seeing some silly movie with Tom Selleck. I can't think of the name. Her Alibi, maybe it's called. I don't know. Anyway, he falls in love with this Romanian woman. And at some point they're speaking Romanian in it. And this was, again, it was like all the things lined up at the right time. And I thought, oh, Romanian, I'm gonna research the Romanian language and, write a paper about how it evolved and why is it the forgotten Romance language and all of that.
Sounds great.
And in order to do that, I met this professor at Columbia University of Romanian language who helped me with this paper. And she was so interested in me that she said I had to come do her summer language course in Romania that summer. And so I begged my parents to let me do that, and they did. And I went to Romania, and it was for college kids and graduate students. So I was like this 15-year-old among, 18 to 30-year-olds. But I had a great time, and I learned Romanian quite well, which I've since, it's quite rusty now. I have not kept it up. But where was I going with this? Oh, so by the end of high school, I knew the Romance languages, and I knew a lot about, Western European languages, and I wanted to go beyond that. And I thought, just practically speaking, what I wanted to look to study something that could cover a large area of the world, because I didn't think I would go into professionally, I didn't think I would go into something that was related to language necessarily. I thought I would go into something where I could use language as a tool. And just for whatever, I mean, for no reason that I can really think of that's logical, I was particularly drawn to, at the time, Brazil, the Middle East, and Eastern Europe. And Brazil felt like very narrow as a sort of regional studies because it was one country. Eastern Europe felt too broad because there were so many languages that I couldn't, how to decide which one to learn. And then there was the Middle East, where I thought, well, I have a great familiarity with Hebrew already. Arabic would be a gateway to, a huge portion of the rest of the region. And if I learn one other one, Turkish or Persian, that would be a nice sort of window into that area of the world. So I chose to focus on the Middle East. So I studied Arabic, Persian, Hebrew, and Yiddish all in university, and all at the same time, which wasn't so difficult because, as I said, I already knew how to read Hebrew. I was very familiar with Hebrew, and learning to read from right to left wasn't a new thing for me, for Arabic, and they're, cousin languages or brother languages, whatever you want to call it. So a lot of the roots, translated over, and so they kind of complemented each other really, really well. And Persian, being Indo-European, was not so difficult. And again, there's so many Arabic loanwords that it only kind of enhanced learning Persian. So it wasn't too difficult to do that. But yeah, I just sort of, I guess I wanted to do something more exotic than the more European languages.
That's a crazy amount of languages just in general, just doing, I don't know how many universities even have that opportunity where you can just study, four languages at a time.
Well, again, that took a lot of convincing because I can't remember his title, but whoever was in charge of my degree, which was in Middle Eastern languages and cultures, said to me, "You can't just do languages; you have to do
History,
history and culture," which
culture,
I was doing. And frankly, I mean, all of the required courses in that degree were history, culture, whatever. And there was a lot of arguing back and forth, but I managed to convince him that, and frankly, I stand 100% behind it, because I wouldn't say that I've forgotten a lot of what I learned in the other classes, but as a tool for continuous learning throughout life, I mean, a week ago I was in an Uber with an Afghani cab driver who spoke Dari, and we could converse in Persian. I mean, just language is the way into talking to people, and I learned infinitely more by talking to people and by reading newspapers in different languages than I did from any of my professors. I hope none of you are listening, of the various culture and history classes. So, and also with those types of classes, there's a lot of information that can just you just sort of forget. So I was very glad that I studied all of those languages.
You got a very practical education you could use,
Yeah.
unless you went on Jeopardy or something. I don't
Right.
know what else you'd use
And
it
I
for.
certainly, I mean, there was plenty of, as I said, there was more than enough history and politics and culture
Of course.
classes that I to fulfill the requirements, I think. I mean, I guess his point was that There were the requirements and then the language requirements and then a whole lot of electives, and he wanted my electives to be more varied, and I said I think that language learning is
I'm
really
not interested. I like how you can just bend all academic rules to your will in several
Yeah, I
occasions.
hadn't really thought of it, but that's always been I've always been doing that, I guess, sort of pushing to learn to learn languages instead of whatever I should be doing. I used to sit in my chemistry class in the back learning languages because I just wasn't interested in chemistry, and I don't advise that to,
Well,
young
some
people
people
who
like
are
chemistry,
listening. Yes, no.
but they'll probably listen to a different
Yeah, it's probably that's probably
podcast,
true.
to
Thank you for listening to the Actual Fluency Podcast.